Please be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We have one case to be submitted today on oral argument, Poole versus City of Houston. Mr. Najvar, but you can correct my pronunciation because I'll probably mess that up.
Yes, Your Honor, that's a frequent inquiry I get here. It's Navar. J is silent.
So it's Navar?
Navar, yes, sir.
Navar, okay. Well, I never would have gotten that right. So.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors. Jared Navar for the plaintiff's appellants. May it please the court. This, as you have probably gathered, is a very unusual procedural situation, but the court is not here, not required to write on a blank slate at all. There are clear principles of federal jurisdiction that dictate that there was no authority under Rule 60B for the district court to do what it did here, which was to reopen this final fee award after Poole 2. So, obviously, we have two panel opinions from this court. It's important to note that those panel opinions are merits panels. They're not motions panels. And the basic point on, so it's sort of the first point I want to establish about how those opinions have to be read together and what they mean in terms of the mandate.
Before you do that, what's the relief you want? You want us to reverse the denial of the fee?
Yes.
As an abuse, okay. And would that necessarily reinstate the declaratory judgment?
Well, if you, I believe so, yes. If the court reverses the, well, the court would have to say something about how these opinions have to be read together.
Why would we give that advisory opinion? And don't we just assess whether or not she abused her discretion in vacating the fee order?
Well, right, but the reason she abused her discretion is because the district court refused to read Poole 2 and Poole 1 together. They're both binding on the district court, and they're both binding on this panel as well. I don't think they have to be read to be in conflict. To the extent there is a conflict,
are you asking us to address Lackey in the first instance ourselves, or that would be left to her?
Well, I think Lackey actually supports the maintenance of the fee award here.
Well, I know you do, but are you asking us to say that? Are you asking us, and if so, is that, would we only do that if we reinstate the declaratory judgment? In other words, when you apply Lackey, it's got to be a judicial act, and the only judicial act here is the declaratory judgment, but that was vacated by Poole 2, is that correct?
Well, this is why I think Poole 2 is a little bit ambiguous and unclear on that point.
The judgment says we're vacating.
The judgment says to vacate the judgment.
Uh-huh.
Plaintiffs actually got more relief after Poole 2 because it said vacate the...
That's true, but you asked that you went up, right?
Well, that's right. We went up, and our argument was that the declaratory judgment should be memorialized in the final judgment, Rule 58, separate document. The city's position all along, trying to avoid that, was to say that the declaratory judgment already sort of referenced in the opinion was already final and permanent and legally binding.
One way of looking at Poole 2 is you asked for too much.
Well, this is why this case presents all sorts of these sort of difficulties procedurally, because Poole 2 did not honor Poole 1, I hope that's clear. That's inarguable in my view.
Well, if it's so clear and inarguable, why didn't you say that in a rehearing petition?
Well, because the rules that govern the mandate on remand dictate what I'm saying here still, that the district court and any subsequent appellate panel cannot simply ignore a prior merits panel of the Fifth Circuit. That Poole 1...
Well, what's your authority that we can turn around and say the prior panel... We're just going to ignore both the opinion and the judgment. What's the best case that says a successor appellate panel of three judges can just look through it and revive Poole 1? What's your best case standing for that application of law of the case?
Sure. Well, these are all.
I don't want all. I want your best case.
Well, sure. U.S. versus Walker for one, 302 Federal 3rd at 324.25.
That's in your brief?
Is the Fifth Circuit opinion, yes, cited in our brief, in the law of the case section.
Okay, and that, just to make sure, that says that a successor panel of three judges can disregard entirely the opinion and the judgment of a prior panel that didn't adhere to the law of the case. That's what I'll see when I get to that case.
Absolutely. Okay. And that's what the law of the case means. That's the only reason the law of the case and the rule of orderliness would ever come up, is if a subsequent panel sees that there's some tension potentially with an earlier panel's decision. And I've summarized here what Walker said, is if there is tension in subsequent panel opinions, the next panel applies the earlier precedent. That's the holding. And what Walker literally said was the panel must, quote, decline to follow, unquote, the later precedent.
And in full, both its analysis and its judgment?
Well, this is what Walker held, is that there was a conflicting earlier opinion, and Walker held the district court or the court of appeals must decline to follow the subsequent precedent, and said, quote, the earlier precedent controls, unquote. That's Walker 324-25. This is also, there's a Fifth Circuit case called FDIC versus Abraham, 137 Federal 3rd at 268. That's from 1998. That's one of the standard statements of the rule of orderliness, where the court said, we are a strict stare decisis court. One aspect of that doctrine to which we adhere without exception is the rule that one panel of this court cannot disregard, much less overrule, the decision of a prior panel. Now,
I think you're conflating opinion and judgment, and Judge Higginson is asking you if the cases that you're referring to make the distinction between the opinion and the judgment.
Well, to the extent that, I mean, the rule of orderliness cases generally say that the opinion of the court, of this court, is part of what the district court applies on in ascertaining what the mandate is. It does that in light of the opinion. That's a general statement of the law. I agree with that as a general matter. To the extent that there could be a disconnect between the written opinion and the mandate, the pull to mandate, the judgment literally says only it must be dismissed without prejudice because there's no case or controversy. That's a general statement of justiciability. It doesn't pick between standing or mootness. So my position is, as a general rule, the opinion of the court is part of the mandate, and it must be strictly adhered to, you know, by the court on remand. To the extent that there is, though, if there's an earlier precedent of this court that conflicts with a later precedent, then even if the mandate were clear that there was a conflict, the rule of orderliness would dictate that the earlier precedent controls. And yes, you literally must disregard the later precedent if it's in conflict. The fact that the pull to mandate, though, gives us a little bit of leeway, and because it doesn't say everything that the opinion says, it just says there's no case of controversy. That can be read and interpreted and applied, and must be, to be a dictate that it be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction because of mootness, not because of lack of standing.
I do agree our law of the case doctrine is tighter than other circuits, but isn't it so tight that there is no miscarriage exception?
Miscarriage exception.
In other words, we've got a pool to, I think it's a published PC opinion. It may be very short, but it's a published opinion. So I thought the law of the case doctrine that you would need would be for us to have authority to say, oh, that's a miscarriage. We're going to look past it.
Well, you do, and I would say.
But then I'm not sure our court has gone with the majority of circuits to even allow it. I think that.
Well, there are cases where this court has recalled a mandate. I recognize normally that's in the context of doing something like correcting it to include, pre or post judgment interest or something like that, sort of on the margins. But there are cases that reflect. I think what Your Honor's referring here to here would be like, if failure to do so would be a miscarriage of justice, then you must do it and you have the authority to do that. And I agree with that. That's in the cases from Wright and Miller. I think it's section 3938, which I cited in our response to the city's Rule 28 letter. So I've got that citation there. There is authority for this court to recall a mandate even to correct a substantive part of an earlier panel opinion.
Let's say you're right and the declaratory judgment's reinstated. Wasn't it tentative? In other words, didn't Judge Rosenthal sort of almost courteously say to the city, do you want to have the opportunity? So this is moving to Lackey. Let's assume we sort of erase Pool 2 opinion and judgment, reinstate the declaratory judgment, so then we're facing the fee issue. And let's even assume we decide we're going to apply Lackey first impression for our court. Does it qualify under Buchanan? Is that how you pronounce it?
I would say Buchanan. I think that's...
I thought Judge Rosenthal was a little tentative in her ruling.
Not on that issue. I think she was tentative more on the TRO, whether the TRO would qualify under Buchanan, not on the declaratory judgment.
But in the declaratory judgment, do you have it there? Isn't it really saying that the district court, I mean, the city would have the opportunity to adjust its ordinance?
Well, okay, so great question. Let me clarify that. Yes, she did say that. But that is the declaratory judgment, and this is clear in her opinion, is a prerequisite to the city's authority to legislate around the charter by an ordinance, because otherwise an ordinance can't trump the city's charter. That's clear under Texas law. And the city, I'm not sure where this, the city has cited a case called Wise versus Lipscomb in their brief. We've cited a case called Steffel versus Thompson, I believe it is. They're both Supreme Court cases. Those cases say precisely the same thing, and they say what I'm saying here, which is, in other words, it's two examples where the Supreme Court has said, the city doesn't necessarily have to like amend the law at issue or repeal it if there's a declaratory judgment that renders it unenforceable. It is by virtue of the court's permanent order rendering it unenforceable that allows the government to legislate around it. And that's exactly what happened in Wise and in Steffel. And that's what Judge Rosenthal did here. And so that's the basis of our argument, which is that this presents such a conundrum. If the declaratory judgment is not in force, if it's vacated because there was no standing to begin with, which can't be done because of Pool 1, then the declaratory judgment goes away, which would mean we're back where we started. The challenge charter provisions are still in the charter. The city's never moved to amend them. What they've done is responded to a declaratory judgment with an ordinance, which without the declaratory judgment, the ordinance is null and void. That's what I argued below. That's what Judge Rosenthal accepted. And in fact, on the record page 1487, the city itself, in their brief, has acknowledged, this is in their the briefing, you know, that Judge Rosenthal requested on remand after Pool 1. The city acknowledged finally at that point that their attempt to legislate around the charter with an ordinance was not intended and cannot be legally binding. That's page 1487 of the record. To address your question, Judge Higginson, about whether the declaratory judgment would be sufficient under Lackey, the answer is unequivocally yes, under the analysis as described in Lackey itself. And this comes from earlier principles. They cite Hanrahan versus Hampton, where Lackey itself says, it reiterates that a prevailing party status can come from piecemeal relief on the merits before a final judgment. So then they're distinguishing a preliminary injunction from merits relief, right? The whole reason that a preliminary injunction was not sufficient was because it's tentative, it's preliminary, it's not final, it's subject to revision. Hanrahan and reiterated in Lackey recognizes the principle that if it's merits relief at some point in the case that's permanent and binding, as a declaratory judgment is, then that still suffices for prevailing party status.
So your argument, would you agree to get anywhere, you've got to reinstate the declaratory judgment?
The declaratory judgment, yes, it has to be recognized to have been supported by standing, which Pool 1 found. And I would submit that there's no basis.
In other words, so there's no way the fee award stands unless you get that judicial win of yours reinstated. And to do that, it's a frontal contradiction of Pool 2. That's why you're arguing law of the case, right?
Well, we would. My first argument is no, it's not a frontal contradiction because, again, Poll 2 is ambiguous in the wording that it used, and it's notable that they never say standing. The Poll 2 says there's no case or controversy. It's almost as if, I mean, I don't know why they did that, but it's as if they didn't want to acknowledge Poll 1. They had to know it was, you know, a published opinion. It was been there for 3 years at the time they wrote. They never cited it or acknowledged it. Yet they didn't go. They didn't say there was no standing. It's as if they're acknowledging it, but they don't want to say it in the opinion. So there was no basis for mootness by the city's own admission until after the summary judgment was entered. And the city itself has said that the summary judgment was permanent and binding, and that their prior that they could not legislate around the charter with an ordinance. Thank you, Your Honors.
You saved time for about. Thank you, Ms. Petty.
May it please the court. I want to do two things today. The first one is to clarify what is properly before the court and what isn't. The second is to demonstrate why the trial court was correct and had jurisdiction to vacate its fee award under both Fifth Circuit authority and the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Lackey.
So you're saying no abuse of discretion to vacate. First argument is Pool 2 binding on the district court binds us. No declaratory judgment, no judicial act.
Right.
Is that the argument?
Essentially, Your Honor.
Are you saying in the alternative, if there were declaratory judgment, that wouldn't meet Lackey's judicial act requirement?
There's not going to be a declaratory judgment.
No, I'm asking you to assume that there is a declaratory judgment. I don't know of any post-Lackey case that wouldn't say that suffices. Are you arguing it or not?
No, Your Honor. If this circumstance exists, and I can explain why it wouldn't, even if they're right about mootness and how that impacts, what Lackey talked about was to have enduring judicial relief on the merits that was granted by a court. And so if there is enduring judicial relief, then Lackey would not apply. But that's not the case here.
Yeah, they would be entitled to their fee.
They would be entitled to discuss.
Okay, so if the declaratory judgment's valid, as you said in your brief on page 7, he cited 1487, I think it's 1587. But at 1587, you direct us to the letter that the city sent to Judge Rosenthal, which states that the ordinance was changed, amended, because of her declaratory judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, but there is authority both from Buchanan, and which is basically the precursor to Lackey. It was kind of a continuum of cases that basically say that if there is a voluntary change, it has to be that is not a qualification for.
Right, but your letter doesn't say voluntary.
And how do you square?
We notify the court, the city passed and adopted in light of the court's memorandum, and then when you look at the ordinance, it says, whereas not just because of Lee Rosenthal, but because of the Fifth Circuit, therefore we amend. How is that not an almost irrefutable example of two judicial acts causing the city to change its ordinance?
Your Honor, they initially did, but both of those have, but the declaratory judgment has been vacated.
No, I know that. That's the first argument. But if we reinstate the declaratory judgment, I was just trying to clear out some brush. If the declaratory judgment is there, it's a classic Lackey, they get the fee.
That would be the case,
okay.
But even if he's correct, if I may go back to the argument, even if he's correct that the case somehow became moot as opposed to lacking in case or controversy from the beginning of the case, the remedy at that point is to vacate the judgment and send the case back to remand the case for dismissal. So whether he's correct on the procedural posture of the case, whether the you follow Pool 2 strictly and say that it was dismissed because it was lacking case of controversy, or whether it was dismissed because it was somehow moot. In both of those situations, the result would be the same, and that is to get rid of the declaratory judgment, vacate the opinion of the trial court, and remand the case for dismissal.
Okay, now that you filed the city's brief back in April of 23.
Correct.
That you, what you've just said is the opposite of what you urged our court, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. We had in our...
Okay, let me just look at it. You recall the brief wasn't a brief. Yes. It was a motion to do what?
No, actually, it was just a Rule 28...
It was a Rule 27 motion to do what?
It was to apprise the court of the Lackey decision.
No. Your brief in April of 23, motion to dismiss the appeal.
Excuse me. Yes.
Why? Why did you tell our court we should dismiss it on appeal? Because the plaintiffs had received all the relief they could get.
Correct.
So you were saying the final judgment is standing, and because of Judge Rosenthal's judgment, this court lacked jurisdiction to hear it on appeal.
Your Honor, that would be correct if there were no Pool 2.
But you told Pool 2 it didn't have authority to hear oral argument, so they didn't hear oral argument.
Correct.
But they did the opposite of what you requested, correct?
No, Your Honor, we had a case or controversy argument in the Pool 2 brief.
But what was the case of controversy cited Lane v. Williams? You said, this circuit, you can't hear this because they've gotten everything. You embraced Judge Rosenthal's final judgment, and you said in the alternative, since they were awarded everything pursuant to a proper judgment, you remember this now?
Correct.
You should what? Affirm. Affirm. How is that possibly consistent with what the Pool 2 panel did and what you're arguing to us now?
Well, Your Honor, the Pool 2 panel, although we had suggested to the court that there was simply no case or controversy, we had to argue the case in front of us. What happened with Pool 2 is the court, sua sponte, looked at it and said there's no case or controversy here. So
They revisited federal jurisdiction.
They revisited federal jurisdiction as they are supposed to do, because they essentially have to assume that the jurisdiction does not exist, and then it's up to the appellant to show that there's federal jurisdiction in this case.
But you told them there was. You told the Pool 2 panel there was federal jurisdiction. How is that not claim preclusion?
Your Honor, we had the case in front of us.
But you could have said to them, you could have said, let's go into the intricacies of law of the case. And there's been a change in law or a change in fact. Therefore, disregard Pool 1, never federal jurisdiction, vacate the judgment. You didn't say any of that. Instead, you endorsed it. You said, we have a federal judgment. It's given them everything. Therefore, you shouldn't have oral argument.
And that was the judgment we had in front of us. It is not, it's not up to the city. Essentially, it's the same position that we're in at this point. What would be required of the city in that case is to say Pool 1 was wrong, and the court should re-examine, the panel in Pool 2 should re-examine Pool 1 and question jurisdiction. Once the court had found jurisdiction, we were bound by the decision of
But you agree they did the opposite of what you told them to do. So they came up with this whole cloth themselves.
No, Your Honor, we had as an alternative argument that there was no case or controversy.
Yeah, but don't you know exactly what you filed? You said no case or controversy because they got everything, not no case or controversy. I can read it to you.
Your Honor, we had alternative arguments. One is they have everything they want. And then when we went back in the Pool 2 appeal, we basically said, oh, by the way, you know, we don't think that there's ever been a case or controversy.
Okay, where do you say that anywhere in the brief? I've read it, counsel. You just said in Pool 2, you made the alternative argument there never was jurisdiction.
It was probably in the introduction.
Okay.
Your Honor, I don't have the brief in front of me.
Yeah, I can tell you, you know where said that. You can file a 28J if I'm wrong. Throughout, you said Judge Rosenthal had jurisdiction, and because of that, because they got all the relief, the court, appeals court, the only case you cite is Lane v. Williams, that they've gotten everything, therefore it's moot. You nowhere ever try to attack Pool 1. I'm not saying you couldn't, because law of the case arguably allows, revisiting if there's a change of law or fact, but I don't see that anywhere in your brief.
I guess I'm not understanding what the court's the ultimate resolution of the court is saying. If the court is basically saying we have somehow waived any.
No, I'm not saying you waived it. I think my view, assessment, tentatively listening to counsel, is your arguments were exactly the right ones. I don't know why they pursued the appeal in Pool 2. You made the exact argument consistent with Pool 1 and district court. Your filing was superb. I'm questioning the position we're in now, so let me ask it differently. Pool 2, on their own, not because of you, commendably, they just changed course. Did they have oral argument? No.
No.
Per curiam, correct?
Per curiam.
I'm not sure if it's a PC or just a short opinion.
Short opinion published, third question. So they, no oral argument. I don't think they even adopted any of the party's requests, but
I don't think so.
You don't think so either, right? Yeah. So it's no oral argument, per curiam, I think published, no party presentation. Did they even mention Pool 1? Have you ever heard of a law of the case where the court that says the earlier panel that should bind us isn't binding without even saying why not?
Yeah, I think what the court did, and it's hard to fathom it because it's a very short opinion.
Yeah.
But I guess I would sort of skip over that because essentially what the plaintiffs and appellants are trying to do here is skip over Pool 2.
Well, they are, but that's why we're picking apart Pool 2 to try to say, is there any coherence to it, or is it a very naked violation of law of the case? We know why they said there was no jurisdiction from the start. They cite a 1911 Supreme Court case. You studied it. And the panel said, we have here a, quote, faux dispute, correct? Isn't that what they said, yes or no?
I think that's what
okay.
they said, yes.
Have you been for the last 5 years colluding with the plaintiffs?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so this isn't a faux dispute case.
No, it isn't, Your Honor. But I think there's a difficulty here in that I don't think it was any naked violation of the law of the case. I think that they had opportunities. As we discussed in our brief, there are exceptions to the law of the case doctrine, including one that basically said if they got it wrong, you can correct it. Now, the fact that they didn't talk about
right. How
they got it wrong is problematic.
Because even a district court can disregard a controlling Fifth Circuit opinion
right. In
the law of the case if they say, look at what you missed, intervening
right. Supreme
Court.
But I think if we go back, though, the question is, this is not for this court. If there was a dispute between Pool 1 and Pool 2, if they were diametrically opposed, the solution was for the appellants in this case to go to the en banc court. We could have done
that's
it this
a strong
week.
Argument. That's a strong
we,
argument.
We could have done it this week, but they didn't.
No, we did not need another en banc.
Oh, sure, why not?
Well, he would have liked another one.
Yeah,
okay, that's so. Explore that a little bit.
Well, the solution, if there is an intra circuit split, is to go to the court and say, look, Pool 2 really messed up. They completely contradicted, or you know, whatever his argument is, they contradicted Pool 1, and you need to tell us what these cases mean, and you need to resolve them. That's the solution. But what they've done in this case is to come to this court, yet another panel of the court, and say, you panel, decide all of the issues that you've just discussed, and probably what we will get then is a fourth appeal in this case, in which there is no case or controversy.
So are you saying we can't, or law of the case is discretionary and we shouldn't, or
law,
both?
You shouldn't, number one, because law of the case doesn't bind courts. It's a discretionary rule.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, this court really isn't empowered to do that. And I would suggest that far from the cities having sort of waived anything, I think it is the plaintiffs who did not attack the alleged dispute between Pool 1 and Pool 2 in the proper forum. For example,
Or I suppose you're saying they had a frivolous suit, which is what you argued. Frivolous first or second appeal.
Correct, because basically all they were asking to do was they didn't like the way that Judge Rosenthal had phrased the order. And so it was, I think it was a pretty frivolous appeal. But getting back to the core point is that they had an opportunity to do an en banc case. They had the opportunity to file a petition for certiorari. They wanted to go to the Supreme Court. When they got back to the trial court, they could have objected in the trial court, but the trial judge recites that all parties agree that the Fifth Circuit's mandate requires that the court to dismiss the case with prejudice. They didn't raise a peep then. It was only when the fees were ordered restored that they decided that there was a conflict. And I would suggest to the court that they've given up their opportunities to do that because, we could keep going forever. They could appeal if this case is remanded.
The fee request was pending during Pool 2, wasn't it?
Correct, yeah. Correct. And the court ordered it, and then I think we all sent letters to the court, yeah, indicating. But that was going to be yet another appeal, a separate appeal,
yeah,
because the timing was wrong on it. But again, there was an opportunity for them to do that. They didn't do it. And what they did do then is say, now there's this big dispute. But there's really not a basis for this court, in addition to it not really being empowered to resolve intra-circuit conflicts, there's really not a legal basis for essentially skipping over Pool 2.
Your brief did, and this is also me commending you, but correct me if I'm wrong, you acknowledge that even jurisdiction is subject to law of the case. Christensen, USPPS.
Correct, but what we did say is that that is the most likely to be resolved, that there is a heightened,
revisited, you mean.
Right, a heightened level of scrutiny is, each court has to determine its own.
But it's not exempt from law of the case,
it's doctrine. Not exempt from law of the case, but it is most likely to be reexamined. And that's, I think, what they did here. They just didn't explain their work. And that's what I think is problematic. But again, there were forums for the court to resolve that. But I'd like to, in the little time I have left, because I think the court, at least my sense was that the court was interested in how Lackey applies in this.
Well, only I mean, my colleagues may not. You got several levels before you get there, but it's okay. Intriguing. We haven't issued an opinion on it, so it's really important.
Well,
I would have thought, just to show my cards, I would have thought a declaratory judgment would easily suffice.
If the declaratory judgment survives, but in this case it did not.
I agree.
The Pool 2 was completely clear on this point, is that Pool 2 vacates the declaratory judgment itself.
I'm fully agreeing. I'm just thinking, if we're setting down a rule going forward,
right,
interpreting Lackey, I don't think this declaratory judgment is somehow infirm or tentative. You don't either.
No.
Okay. In other words, this is not a litigation catalyst theory that was discredited if the declaratory judgment exists.
Right. Right. However, all of the arguments that the Pool appellants are making here were made in the dissent in Lackey, saying, well, you got a voluntary result, or you got sort of substantive relief, or you got all of these things. And Lackey rejected every one of those arguments. And
you mean as to the TRO and the PI?
Correct,
yeah.
Correct. But basically, I think the Lackey decision can be read a little bit more broadly, which is, unless you have enduring, and that I think is the operative decision, unless you have enduring judicial relief on the merits that materially alters the legal relationship, then you don't get fees.
But how does your preamble square with that? Because you say in the preamble that of the ordinance, that the ordinance was changed in light of the decision that you got from Judge Rosenbaum.
Well, that's correct, but even under those circumstances, Lackey would say that because of the dismissal of the declaratory judgment, that's fine, and then when you go back to the...
But you started your argument off by saying even if they had the declaratory judgment.
But I thought that I conceded to Justice Higginson is that if it somehow could survive, which we do not believe it could under Pool 2 or under any principle of dismissal related to mootness, which is the theory that is proposed by the Pool appellants in this case, even under those circumstances, it can't survive. But if it somehow could, I think the city has to concede that there would be enduring judicial relief on the merits that materially alters it. But the idea of something that that Houston did in reliance upon a decision that has now been vacated, I think is specifically excluded under Lackey.
You didn't argue pool one. You've just been called in to clean it up for a bunch of years.
Essentially. although yeah, I mean,
not
I think,
teasing you.
You know, I think that if this court were full and this were the en banc court, all of these issues, I think, would be properly before the court. But it's just you guys. And as esteemed as the panel is, this is not a case where this panel is empowered to resolve what they're alleging is a dispute between two opinions.
We could if we saw a miscarriage. Let's say an intervening Supreme Court opinion. Then we could correct Pool 2.
Correct.
You just say there's no miscarriage here?
But there's not here. The only intervening Supreme Court case is Lackey, which I think fully supports Houston's position. And there's not really been a miscarriage here. I think the miscarriage, frankly, was in Pool 1 in Judge Acosta's basically saying that we're not going to look at adversariness. We're going to go back to a deposition question by outside counsel 7 years before, or we're going to look to the fact that the city, and Judge Smith knows that cities are not the most efficient things from his time as city attorney in Houston, that the fact that Houston didn't put any sort of indicator in its notation in its charter about the Buckley decision. But aside from those, there is nothing that has changed the circumstance that would empower this court to go back and say, we're going to just ignore Pool 2. We're going to go back to Pool 1, which was tentative, which was based on amended pleadings, which was...
a lot of what you say makes sense, except now you're attacking Pool 1. You didn't seek rehearing as to Pool 1.
No.
So it's sort of the same en banc point. You should be pointing at everybody if you didn't like Pool 1.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, there's nothing that says, and I think that's part of Lackey, but it's also part of Flowers. It's also part of the Shalala case that we cite in our brief at 55 and 56. All of those cases say we were not required to either appeal Pool 2 or Pool 1 to avail ourselves of Rule 60b-5.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Petty. Mr. Navar for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. And a few quick points. Number one, I just want to clarify that I believe the law of the case and the rule of orderliness does show that this panel does have the power. Of course, you can't reform a prior panel opinion on the merits if there's no conflict. But if there are two prior panel opinions and there is a conflict that you see, the law of the case and the rule of orderliness does provide a way for you.
A way, the power, but you agree it's discretionary.
It's discretionary, but...
So why would we ever exercise our discretion when you chose not to take, as she said, the vehicle that was available to you? Second you see Pool 2 and it's just a horrific violation of law of the case, you didn't even ask the panel to be here.
Well, because as Your Honor recognized earlier, the law of the case is binding on the district court.
But you didn't tell them that.
No, right, but we did. Well, we did tell the district court. When they, first of all, Pool 2 comes out...
Well, Judge Rosenthal's not going to... What you're telling me is when I go back and look at the remand, you told Judge Rosenthal to ignore Fifth Circuit opinion, but she said the opposite. I'm not going to ignore Fifth Circuit opinion.
Well, and in doing that, she ignored Pool 1, which is not proper.
Right. But you heard opposing counsel has a power. If this isn't jurisdictional, law of the case, and it's not, and it's discretionary. First of all, you see the predicament you're asking us. You're asking us to commit the same sin. You're asking us to disregard a panel, but your argument is they disregarded a panel.
Well, if you, I mean, you know, I'm asking you to disregard a subsequent panel to the extent it conflicts with an earlier panel, which is simply what the law of the case requires.
But what mystifies me is why didn't you ask for even panel rehearing the minute you saw it? And isn't that the end of the story in terms of discretionary review?
Right. Well,
you may be right about everything, but we're not going to get into an endless cycle, as the lawyer said, against our colleagues. Then it comes back up and they say we're wrong.
Well, let me answer the question.
Yeah.
And it goes to Your Honor's point, frankly. I'm tired of this case, honestly. This court's tired of this case. I've filed three appeals so far. I think this is the fourth, because there was an appeal of, there was a protective appeal of a fee award earlier. Pool 2 came out and I was completely stunned by it. I saw immediately that it's in conflict with Pool 1. I researched the law of the case. Law of the case is binding on the district court as well as the panel of this court. So rather than try to continue the cycle in the Court of Appeals, rather than seek, you know, to have 17 judges sit in this room, I went to Judge Rosenthal and I said, look, both, and literally, my brief is there. I started off saying, there's two opinions. They're both binding. I mean, there's no dispute about that. We can't just ignore Pool 1. This court can't, and the district court can't either. So she was in a pickle.
Arguably, I mean, I'm not trying to dignify Pool 2, but that panel did say, and you had a judge on both panels, I'm sure you've noticed. Pool 1, you had Judge Engelhardt. Pool 2, there he is. So he knows Pool 1.
I did.
But they came up with a different theory. It is, I think it's fair to say, instead of standing in mootness, they said they went back to this old Supreme Court decision and said no adversity. And they cite this very narrow doctrine called the faux dispute doctrine, where courts don't have jurisdiction if parties are colluding. That's never been in this case before, but all of a sudden that's the basis for the ruling. Lee Rosenthal can't disregard that new basis. You have to say to the panel, no one's ever argued that to you, panel, and there's no factual support for collusion. We've been at the throats of each other for 5 years, but you didn't.
Well, one of the reasons I made the argument to the district court in the first instance to apply the law of the case and reconcile these opinions was because Pool, as I've argued consistently, Pool 2 does not have to be read. They can be reconciled because of, again, Pool 2 doesn't say there's no standing directly. They say there's no case or controversy. That encompasses mootness. And that was the argument. I said you can read it that way to reconcile both of them. There's no argument. I want to make this point before my time ends. There's no argument, and the city has actually conceded, this is in their brief at 22 to 23, to the extent there's a question, because you're right, Judge Higginson, nobody has yet addressed the question of when did mootness supposedly attach. If you read Pool 2 to mean there was, it must be dismissed without prejudice because mootness attached, you have to recognize what the city itself has said, which is that the mootness came after the declaratory judgment when the plaintiffs conceded they didn't have to resurrect their Second Amendment complaint and argue all their constitutional challenges to the new ordinance. That's when mootness happened. But you can't undo the declaratory judgment. And so in other words, if this court were to simply say, look, Pool 2 must be read, reconciled with Pool 1 to mean that mootness attached at the time Pool 2 was decided, there may still be a question of, you don't have to specifically say the declaratory judgment must be reinstated because that's what that would mean. The district court on the first instance might have to examine the question, okay, if Pool 2 means that, then when did mootness attach and does it leave the declaratory judgment intact? That could still be a question available on remand. But, so you wouldn't necessarily have to answer that question.
Thank you,
Governor. Thank you, Mr. Navar. Your case is under submission and the court is in recess under the usual order.
Thank you, Your Honor.